This is The End User, episode 169 for Tuesday, April 29th. Really fast living rooms. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
Taylor, we have a stacked week of news this week.
So much news.
Yeah, a lot going down this week.
Okay, so the first thing is something that we've talked about a lot already on the show this year, and that is the coming change in regulations of the FCC, which has been sort of a protracted legislative battle that is essentially going to dismantle pieces of net neutrality for carriers in the U.S.
Yeah, this is a really complicated issue. It's pretty dense and it's a pretty deep. We could get a real lawyer on the show, and I'm sure that would be a very interesting conversation. But the last time we talked about them, I think, the court had said that they would have to claim the rights that they tried to claim. They would have to declare that the internet is a common carrier, and that as they failed to do so, they in fact did not have jurisdiction to regulate them.
Right. And so these new regulations or the implementation of these regulations also allows content provider companies to pay the last mile providers.
Right.
Like Comcast and Verizon for different tiers of service. So it's not just the consumers who can pay for different packages and levels of internet content depending on what the carrier decides to provide, but it's also the companies creating them having to pay for special pipes to get access to consumers.
Right, and I think, again, this is a very complicated issue, but what we all wanted to see, we being, you know, the people of the internet, you know, the people that are paying attention to this, is to see the FCC declare the internet as a common carrier and declare that they had the authority to regulate companies that would behave in anti-net neutrality behavior. And what we got was kind of the opposite. I'm a little surprised by that.
Yeah, the last time that we were talking about these changes, we directed our listeners to an internet petition to the White House, which needed 100,000 signatures to get an official response to the White House. As far as I know, it didn't get 100,000 signatures, but as someone who signed the petition, I received a response anyway, where the White House declared their support for net neutrality. However, that doesn't really change the situation at all in this context. So there is a new petition to the White House to get them to respond to the current developments in the death of net neutrality. And I'm expecting probably the same tepid response, both from the public at large and the White House public relations office.
Well, so the FCC seems to be saying that they're not going to regulate against companies that engage in this kind of behavior, but it seems to me like they're making some kind of implicit free market argument where they seem to think that we have enough competition that if, let's say, Comcast started charging for a special faster pipe to Netflix, that even though that kind of violates net neutrality as we know it, that their users would be so outraged that they would switch to another provider. And I don't really buy that. Of course, I'm also stuffing words in their mouth, but it seems like to me that we don't have enough competition to not regulate this.
Yeah, well, it's definitely true in most cases in the United States that there's not at all enough competition. I've lived in many places where I didn't have any reasonable options for internet carriers. There was just the one. And that is only going to be exacerbated by the upcoming merger of Comcast and Time Warner, the biggest internet providers in the country. And when they join, they will be competing only in specialized markets with small cable service providers and the handful of places where you can get fiber services like Google Fiber or AT&T UVerse or Verizon Fios, which Verizon is no longer expanding into any new markets.
Yeah, so I think this is bad news all around. I'm not sure I can spin this into a good thing. The only thing I might be able to say is that maybe we were worried about what ends up being a non-problem, right? Like, it is not really something that is happening, and therefore to regulate against it would be fruitless.
Sure, yeah. There's always the argument that nothing bad has happened yet, and so there's no reason to think that anything bad has happened, except that the company who benefits the most from this ruling also happens to be the lowest rated company in customer satisfaction in the United States year after year.
Yeah.
And so that's worrisome.
Yeah, that's not exactly encouraging, is it?
It is not.
So again, I think just looking at this from the consumer's perspective, the right thing for us would have been to declare the internet as it is, as a common carrier and as a utility. And that, I think, would have been the right thing for the consumer. But it seems like the lobbying power of Comcast and the other ISPs is too much. And, you know, I'm not sure if, like, the FCC was lobbied into making this decision, but I don't know. That's where we are right now, I guess.
The players involved in the lobbying organizations are so large and convoluted and interconnected. I mean, many of the top executives at the FCC are once and future lobbyists, and there's just a lot of crossover there. There is a lot of specialized industry discussion about the technologies at play here that I don't even fully understand.
Yeah.
And most people have no hope of understanding. And so the public responses that these companies are giving offer no insight as to why this is really happening. I mean, the FCC wrote these regulations that clearly implemented net neutrality in a straightforward and relatively uncomplicated way, except that it stipulated that these rules only applied to common carriers. And it seems self-evident that the common carrier label should definitely apply to the private companies providing the last mile internet services that almost everyone in the United States has. But they don't. And the only reason that I can see for that to be the case is an extensive lobbying effort.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, but I think we don't know all the details, and the details are not being provided to us. So we cannot say for sure, and we can't do anything about it.
Yeah, that's the funny thing is the amount of information that the FCC has poured out at this point in time is minuscule. So you look at what they have written, and it is not a lot of information. So I also kind of wonder if they're just kind of opening the account and they are going to have more details later or something like that. And they're trying to see, you know, what the public reaction to this would be or something like that. But it seems awfully strange to me.
Maybe I should start faxing some FOIA requests.
Yeah, there you
go.
The
end user can get into investigative reporting.
Yeah, let's do it.
Do you have a fax machine?
No, I don't. I definitely don't have a fax machine.
I've submitted several FOIA requests. I'm sure that there is another way, but that was the most effective way when I was submitting them the last time I did, which was half a decade ago.
We can't just tweet at FOIA request?
That would be so great if we could. I don't think we can fit enough information into 140 characters.
Yeah, probably not. All right, well, let's move away slightly from the FCC and into we talked previously about Netflix signing a deal with Comcast so that they could pay them for the peering arrangement they had. Remember, we talked about that. That was also a complicated issue.
And this is exactly the kind of specialized paid access from content providers that we were just talking about in relation to net neutrality.
Well, there are some that would claim that this these kind of peering arrangements really have nothing to do with net neutrality, that this is just a reality of the internet. And when you are a content provider that slings a lot of traffic at the networks of Comcast and Verizon, that you end up having to pay for that because you're sending a lot of traffic over and it costs them money to pay to handle that kind of traffic. I never really bought that. But it's a more complicated issue than just saying this is a net neutrality violation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're technologically separate and distinct, but they definitely have the same philosophy behind it. I mean, the fact is that the performance of Netflix on Comcast and Verizon has been tracked repeatedly and demonstrably to be declining. So it had been getting worse over the last 2 years, and that is accounting for increases in traffic on Netflix and overall. So the performance of Netflix streaming has been getting worse no matter which way you cut it, until Netflix started paying Comcast and now Verizon. Now, it didn't have to be this way. Netflix invented a whole new server technology, and they said, hey, let us put a server in your backbone, and it'll improve the service with no cost to you whatsoever. And Comcast came back, and then Verizon said the same thing, said, no, you can pay us, and then we'll make your services faster.
Yeah, so Verizon and Netflix will now have a similar deal that Comcast and Netflix worked out.
Right.
So again, I'm with you. I think that it is a deeper issue that can be explored a little further. But as long as Netflix has to pay for the performance of their application, that doesn't seem quite right. And the answer to that is a very complicated argument and a very technical argument. And it seems like you can distill all that away and just say, you know, well, okay, now the content provider of Netflix has to pay for access to Comcast and Verizon's network. I don't fully understand why that doesn't violate what we hold up as net neutrality from the consumer's perspective, even if the FCC can't do much about it. So we're stuck, Taylor. Now we are holding up net neutrality. If you say that's a net neutrality violation, then you can say yes, but there is no net neutrality.
Yeah, we can't make that argument anymore. Rennie in the chat room just reminded us that we talked about last week, Netflix decided they are raising their rates for their streaming plans, and it comes directly on the heels of the news that they've begun paying carriers for faster service. Coincidence?
Well, so anyway, I think this issue is so nuanced and it's so hard to pick apart. It's really difficult for anyone who is not a day-to-day lawyer in the business to really pick it apart in a meaningful way for most people. And you look out there and most people just aren't even aware that this is potentially an issue. And so there will be many words spilled after this, and we'll see what everyone's reaction is. But I think that this is definitely going to be bad for consumers. And yeah, I think you're right. It's going to lead to increased prices for us.
It already has.
Yes.
Maybe, probably.
All right. Well, let's get into something a little more fun and a little more in our wheelhouse, mind you. Well, let's talk a little bit about automated driving. And Taylor, as some listeners may or may not know, I don't even have a driver's license, and I think this is the most awesome thing I've ever seen.
It is pretty awesome.
So, you know, we've talked about the Google self-driving car before, but what they've done here is they've written a little blog post about what they've done more recently, and they have started to bring these autonomous vehicles into a more urban setting. So, you know, they bring the driver with the car, you know, for safety's sake, in case the car does something crazy, and they have to sit there and make sure the car doesn't do anything crazy. And it's able to look at the cars beside it and stop at stoplights and sense pedestrians and not run them over, that kind of thing. And it's really come a long way since we probably last talked about it. I think the last time we talked about it, they were just doing highway driving. And driving in an urban setting is definitely a lot more complicated.
Yeah, definitely can be much more complicated. And this is obviously the next evolution of this. I mean,
yeah.
They're developing this technology to sell it for implementation in real cars. But the most amazing thing to me is that they were able to do all of this, and essentially they are very small steps away from a marketable self-driving car. They did it all with an onboard camera and a computer that's not even connected to the internet.
Well, and they have the LiDAR on the top of it as well.
Right.
They've got a bunch of other sensors on the vehicle, so it's kind of aware of its surroundings.
Well, my point is that for decades, car companies have been investing in these technologies to get cars to communicate with one another and build new smart street grid networks in attempts to create an internet of cars, right? And Google managed to make the whole process autonomous to the car in a cost-effective way.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, it's we look at autonomous vehicles, and I think the issue is not necessarily the technology. Clearly, Google is getting very good at this. Having the ability to go through an urban setting in a car like this and not run anyone over is an incredibly complex task. And I think it's more of a social issue as to not seeing this, you know. And the cars probably aren't quite ready yet, even. But there's more of a social issue, you know. We don't want to relinquish control of our vehicles. And I say that as someone who doesn't have a vehicle or a license to drive a vehicle, but the Royal We makes sense anyway. We just won't give it up. And we're slowly seeing updates happen where, you know, the car will park itself or whatever. And, you know, we've got lane drifting assist that will beep at you if you drift in your lane, stuff like that. We keep seeing these little tiny things that happen to kind of assist you in driving the vehicle. But what we're starting to see from Google is a mature technology platform that has been driving without accident for quite some time, and for the most part seems pretty reliable. So I wonder if they do end up releasing some kind of autonomous vehicle in the near future, what is the social reaction to that? What is the social reaction to giving up the hands on the wheel kind of experience in a car?
Okay, here's my futurist prime prediction. You ready? As soon as marketable self-driving cars, Google or otherwise, begin to develop a track record that is better than the average driver,
yeah,
insurance companies will start offering discounts for people who buy self-driving cars.
Oh, that's
those
an interesting
discounts
angle. Yeah.
Will begin to increase to the point where several years down the road, it will be prohibitively expensive for many people to buy a new car that does not have a self-driving capability. And that will begin a sea change of people buying self-driving cars or retrofitting cars to be self-driving. And then there will be a new generation of cars which are only self-driving. They're driverless. So it's the whole experience of the car transforms to something where it's just a place where you sit as you're going somewhere and you can do whatever it is that you want. And then people who have old-style cars where even though they're not driving, they still have to sit in the driver's seat with a steering wheel and potentially have their foot on the brake just in case. They will become jealous of the people with these newfangled cars, which are basically just really fast living rooms.
Really fast living rooms. I like it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I'm afraid that is so far into the future, Taylor, that will be the time period, and you can confirm this since you're from the future, that will be the time period when we have the entirety of the human race has receded underground in a bunker in Washington State, and we are slowly evolving into mole people. It's going to take a while.
What are you saying, that mole people won't have cars?
Yeah, maybe we'll have underground cars by then. We'll have a system of tubes.
Obviously.
Mole tubes.
That was a given. I didn't think I had to explain the mole tubes.
Yeah, no, but more seriously, I'm liking what I see here, and I can't wait to see what actually happens socially when they introduce some vehicles like this. So I bet you Google will partner with some car manufacturer like Lexus or whatever, and we'll start to see these in the next, you know, decade or so.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the way it's going.
All right, and finally for our top news segment, we've got some good news for Amazon Prime users. They are soon going to get a couple select HBO shows available for streaming on Prime. And it's none of the recent stuff. It's a bunch of the back catalog stuff. So The Wire, Sopranos, 6 Feet Under, and Deadwood. And I guess Band of Brothers as well is the other one, which I haven't seen. So it's not going to be the more recent episodes, which is a little bit disappointing. But what's major about this is not necessarily that Amazon is getting it. It's that HBO is giving it up.
Yeah, this is the first time in the U.S. that HBO content will be available on a streaming service that isn't HBO Go. And HBO Go, everywhere outside of Scandinavia, requires a current subscription to HBO on cable. Now, there are certain exceptions to that. Notably, the CEO of HBO said he doesn't mind if people share their subscription information in order to watch HBO Go streaming, but you still technically need log information from a cable network that verifies that you are an HBO subscriber.
Right. So the of the shows that are going to be available, that'll start happening on Amazon Prime May 21st. So late next month is when that'll actually happen. And like you said, for the more recent stuff, you've got to get the HBO Go app.
Well, Chris, I suggest that you binge on Band of Brothers over Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, I'm going to hop in my automated Mole Man tube and just binge on Band of Brothers on the way to work.
There you go. Well, that might take a little longer than the weekend. So maybe also watch it in your very slow living room as well.
All right, so speaking of Mole Men, I think we can turn the afterburners on and accelerate ourselves through the Mole Men tubes and move a little bit faster through the stories here. So why don't you get us started, as long as your seatbelt is securely fastened, with some Apple news.
Okay, yeah, I've got my seatbelt on, and we've got a bunch of Apple news that we're going to go through really quickly. The first is that if you have an iPhone 5 with a power display button, that's the button at the top, not the home button on the front of the device, that's acting janky, you may be able to take it in and get a free replacement. So this is officially called the iPhone 5 Sleep-Wake Button Replacement Program that will essentially replace your whole phone if your button is acting up. This applies even if the warranty of your phone has expired. And it's based on the serial number of your iPhone 5. And you probably cannot use this service to get a cracked screen fixed. And it will automatically update you to iOS 7. But if you have an iPhone 5, you should definitely go check out the website and see if your serial number qualifies you for an automatic replacement. Because at this point, your iPhone 5 is more than a year and a half old, and you would at the very least get a new battery.
Yeah, and that's a big deal, getting a new battery, actually.
Yeah, it totally is. But the main thing is, if your home button is not working, you should take it to an Apple store and see if it can be repaired or replaced, or check the serial number online. And if you have a different iPhone or your iPhone 5 is working fine, you might want to upgrade to iOS 7.1.1, which has some more improvements to the keyboard, to Touch ID, and some bug fixes. No major security vulnerabilities in the previous software version. But if you like to keep up to date, you should know that there is a new one. However, if you have jailbroken your iPhone, don't update because there's no new jailbreak for the update yet. And you should also be aware of an active malware campaign that is stealing passwords only from jailbroken iPhones. So this is a security vulnerability that hooks into a function called SSL write and can steal your password. And there are a number of sophisticated things you can do to protect yourself from this bug. If you have a jailbroken iPhone, you should read the Ars Technica posts in our show notes if you hadn't heard about it already.
And in the first time that I've known them to do this, Apple was opening up a beta program for any user that wishes to go on the beta track in this case. So currently they're offering 10.9.3 update for anyone who wishes to opt into that. So that's kind of cool. It reminds me of the Chrome Canary Channel dealio.
Yeah, this is great, and I'm definitely going to participate in this free open beta program. I wonder if they will continue to offer public betas in the future, you know, perhaps for OS 10.10.
Yeah, that would be a cool thing.
And in a bit of Apple rumor news, we are expecting a refresh line of MacBook Airs tomorrow. Today is Monday the 28th, and if you're listening to this on our feed, there may already be new MacBooks Air.
Yeah, so I guess we'll find out. By the time you are listening to this, not on the live stream, but on the published podcast feed, we will know already. So it'll be interesting to see if they cook up anything good there. We'll talk about it next week if they did.
9 to 5 Mac expects slightly faster processors, which is interesting because the line of processors for low-power notebooks made by Intel on their Haswell platform have not been updated. So they may be going with a slightly more powerful processor in the same line. But yeah, we really can't say because it hasn't actually been announced yet.
So the Microsoft Nokia deal is finally done. It went through on April 25th. So Microsoft is now merging in the Nokia devices and services businesses. So it's good to see. We kind of knew that was going to happen. We've talked about it before, but now it has actually happened. So good to see them.
Well, and the news here is that they are hinting that they will be eliminating the Nokia brand entirely so that these will be Microsoft-branded devices in the future.
Yeah, and we'll see what happens with that. I bet you they haven't even made that decision yet.
Probably not, but they have made some public statements to that effect.
So, Taylor, I'm very excited. I downloaded the Windows Phone 8.1 remote desktop application from Microsoft. Microsoft released this not too long ago, and you know, I can use it to get into my server, and it's been something that Microsoft has never done before, and there have been plenty of third-party remote desktop apps, but now there's an official client from Microsoft for Windows Phone 8.1, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is actually really, really cool. I always enjoyed the remote desktop functionality built into Windows XP, and it makes sense that they would continue in that tradition and make it a little more cross-platform. I like that a lot. And another thing that Microsoft is adding that is long overdue is free group video calling on Skype, but they don't have it rolled out for mobile platforms either.
Right, right. So, but they're going to do that over time. So we'll see that. We'll see that kind of get rolled out to all the platforms. They've got a ton of platforms. There's even an old Skype client for Linux still. I'm not sure how well maintained that client is, but I have to imagine they'll roll this out to all the major platforms.
And we've got news about the Samsung Galaxy Tab 4. They will be arriving in the U.S. On May 1st, just for the Wi-Fi models. They have not announced a release date for the LTE models of the Galaxy Tab 4 lineup. And that includes the 8.0 8-inch tablet and the 10.1. And then wasn't there also a 12.1-inch tablet?
Yeah, I don't know. It's getting hard to keep track of all of Samsung's tablet offerings.
And there's also the 7.0. So there's a 7-inch, an 8-inch, a 10-inch, and a 12-inch, which are all coming to different carriers, eventually, but right now Wi-Fi only, May 1st.
So Netflix is going to launch a new application on TiVo devices centered around three cable television providers that offer TiVo boxes. So we've got three of them. There's RCN Telecom, which is actually my internet cable provider. We've got Atlantic Broadband, and we've got Grande Communications. So those relatively smaller cable companies are going to have a TiVo box that has Netflix on it, which is not something we've seen before.
Yeah, pretty cool. Maybe there will be some TiVo users who didn't realize that they could watch Netflix online, and now they will.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, my toaster has Netflix. How is it possible that TiVo didn't have any Netflix? So glad to see that happen.
So for this week's The End User Public Service Announcement, we want to make you aware of a flash vulnerability that is actively being attacked on Internet Explorer for Windows. That's Internet Explorer 6 through 11 are all vulnerable to this flash vulnerability. And the exploit is also effective, but not actively being exploited on Linux and OS X implementations of Flash as well. Adobe has already issued a patch for this, so if you use Flash, particularly on a Windows machine on Internet Explorer, you should download the latest version of Adobe Flash and update to it.
Yeah, so definitely something that people should be patching up.
On any platform, but especially Windows.
So Ubuntu has released its latest operating system. It's full of a bunch of fixes and kind of polish on what they were offering previously. It's out now, and it's called Trusty Tahr. That's T-A-H-R. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce that one.
Right. So that is Ubuntu 14.04, which is a long-term support edition, meaning if you were using 12.04, this would be a good time to update, and this edition will be fully supported on all hardware for the next 3 years, I think, unless they change it to 5.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I forget.
So if you're an Ubuntu user, you probably already knew about this, but it's worth checking out. They have also built in some touch functionality, which is still in the early development phase. You probably don't want to be using that full time, but it gives us a taste to come. Of the touch functionality that will be included in the future. And speaking of the future of Ubuntu, we've got the name for the next version, which will come out about 6 months from now, and it will be known as Utopic Unicorn, which actually leads me to think that it will never come out because neither utopias nor unicorns exist.
Yeah, it's just a mythical name, so maybe we won't see it. Or maybe we'll see it in the years of the Mole Men tubes that we were talking about.
Yes, right.
It'll just take a while.
This Mole Man society is a utopia to you, is that right?
Apparently. There are probably unicorns also underground, because we've gotten smart enough to take them with us.
That would explain why they're always solid white. They're albinos, because they have no pigmentation.
Yeah, there you go.
It all makes sense now.
All right. Well, let's turn off the afterburners. We'll move into the end user stories. And we've got just a couple of them, including your green tech, which we'll get to. I wanted to talk a little bit about a new offering from Amazon, which seemed kind of interesting. It's called Prime Pantry. And it's basically a grocery store delivery service from Amazon. So you pay an extra $6 a month on top of your existing Prime membership. So it seems like an interesting offering from Amazon. It's $6 a month on top of the existing Amazon Prime fee. Isn't a whole lot. And I guess it depends on what kind of groceries they're offering. So I looked it up, and it's only in selected markets for the moment, and it is in my market, so I might give this a shot.
Now, how is this different from the subscribe and save delivery stuff that they had before?
Well, yeah, that wasn't for like fresh groceries. That was for, I don't know, like paper towels and stuff sometimes. But this is a different kind of class of thing that you can buy. It's more like, I don't know, the other one that comes to mind is Giant Peapod. I think that's a regional thing, though. But it's more in line for groceries than it is for you know, packaged products.
Right. So Giant Peapod has, they deliver perishable items. So do you think Amazon will be delivering perishable items through the mail?
You know, it doesn't say that here, but I'm looking through the products that they have on the website, and it looks like it's all like water, oil, soft drink and juices and tea and coffee, that kind of stuff.
Shelf-stable product.
Yeah, shelf-stable, right. That's exactly it. So there's no, like, apples, right?
No produce.
Yeah.
No bread? I wonder if there's bread. Eggs? Yep. Milk?
No, I don't think that stuff is in line here.
Mm-hmm. So it's not going to completely replace your trip to the grocery store.
Yeah, no, not entirely. Not entirely. And then Peapod does deliver those kind of things.
Exactly. Okay, so that's still pretty cool. But even though this is, I assume, part of Amazon Prime, there is a flat fee for the delivery of $6.
Right.
And for up to 45 pounds.
Right. They put a limit of 45 pounds on it so you don't go too crazy.
I want to see how crazy you can go with 45 pounds.
Yeah, that's a lot of weight. 45 pounds of paper towels turns out to be a pretty sizable delivery, I bet.
Well, if it's a flat fee, your best... If it's a flat fee and everything is shelf-stable, then you're best off trying to optimize and getting as close to 45 pounds as you want.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll be sure to test this. Although I you would have to pony up enough money to buy 45 pounds worth of paper products. That might be a lot.
Okay, so can we move on to my green tech story of the week here?
Yes, let's get into your green tech. What do you got for us?
This is a lot more green and a lot less tech than we usually talk about. But I bring this up because I've been watching the Fox science series Cosmos starring Neil deGrasse Tyson. Have you been watching Cosmos, Chris?
Yes, it's probably my favorite show that's on at the moment.
It is endlessly fascinating. And a few weeks ago, Mr. Tyson said something very interesting when he was talking about the photosynthesis factory that occurs in pretty much any plant that's green in it. Chloroplasts are the thing that makes plants green, and they are what turns sunlight into energy for the plant that allows it to grow. And it is, we've known for a long time that it is one of the most efficient sunlight conversion devices that has ever been studied. And we've been a little baffled by how it works as well as it does for as long as we've been studying plants, so for several hundred years. And what Neil deGrasse Tyson said on Cosmos the other week was that if we could unlock the secret that plants use chlorophyll to get energy out of sunlight, it would spark a revolution that would lead to free energy across the world. It would instantly make humanity carbon neutral or carbon negative in nature. We could power just about anything we want if we could recreate the chlorophyll energy conversion process and use it directly to our benefit. Now, we totally do use it to our benefit. Just about all the energy that we create, if it doesn't come directly from the sun or from other sun byproducts like wind or water, you know, all of the oil that we use, all of the biofuels that we use come from, at some point, plant matter converting sunlight into energy. And in the case of oil, that happened millions of years ago when it broke down and created sludge underneath the ground. And in the case of biofuels, we're taking that and turning it into our own new fuel. Or in the case of food, we eat the plants or we give the plants to animals and they turn it into energy and then we use that energy ourselves. But if we could directly tap into the process that turns sunlight into energy that plants use every single day, it would completely revolutionize the way we think of power and energy on this planet and would be a huge advancement for humanity in the long term. Now, the show, that episode of Cosmos, was recorded several months ago, but last month, an article published in Science identifies some of the key features of the chloroplast process that turns that sunlight into energy. And we've figured out how the plant communicates those signals in order to efficiently make use of the energy and its root system. So that revolution that they were talking about on Cosmos, we've taken a big step in understanding that part. So there's no technology that comes directly from this. Nothing is going to change. There's no there's no consumer impact on this, but if you've been watching Cosmos and you remember the scene that I'm talking about, we are one step closer to that green revolution.
Right. This is a baby step in the beginning and is going to require a lot more research to do anything about this. But
I would say that this is more than a baby step. This is a step. It's not a giant leap, but it's a step.
Yeah.
It's a full-size step.
Cool. All right. Well, hopefully we can take advantage of that sometime in the future. But for now, we are going to skip tip of the week this week. But we do have a full three related app picks. So the theme of the week for our app pick is 2048. So what is 2048?
This is a game that I just discovered and have been kind of obsessed with. It's one of those simple number-based games that has very easy controls. And the goal is to just add sets of two, if you are familiar with your powers of two, you may know that 2048 is 2 to the 11.
To the 11, okay.
Anyway, so you get a bunch of twos on a grid, and when they combine, they turn into four, and then two fours turn into eight. You can only combine like numbers. I'm not explaining it very well. It's a really simple game, and it's very addictive, and it was built in HTML5 and is hosted on GitHub for free. And you can also find it, you can run it on HTML5 on just about any platform, but you can also find unlicensed app versions on pretty much any platform. And on top of that, it doesn't need numbers to work necessarily because there's a color code that's associated with it. So people have been making some interesting knockoffs that are not number-based. And Chris, do you want to tell us about some of those that you've found?
Yeah, so we've got two quality 2048 clones. Developers have been going crazy with this game. The first of which is Doge2048.com, and that has the Doge instead of the numbers. So they combine into a different kind of Doge, and it plays little messages while you're kind of playing the game. And it is just so wow. So the second one is Flappy 2048, which is a Flappy Bird clone of 2048. So you start off with a tile with the number one on it, and then you have to navigate a successive amount of columns that also have numbers on it. So developers have definitely been having a lot of fun with this, and it's kind of cool to see such collaboration out there.
Yeah, and so it's a really fun game, no matter which version you play. It's very addictive. So I'm sorry, and I'm not sorry that I've introduced this to our listeners. I've been playing it entirely too much this week. So with that, should we move on to our kicker?
Yeah, let's get into the last story of the week.
Our kicker this week starts in 1983 in the high desert of New Mexico.
So, Taylor, did you know of the Atari game, E.T., the Extraterrestrial?
I didn't know about it at the time. I wasn't born yet. But I had heard rumors of its announcement and sudden disappearance.
Yeah. So I had heard of this before, too. And apparently, as the legend goes, there was a game that was made, and it was in conjunction with the release of the movie, E.T., and they released this video game for the Atari that was just laughably and unbearably awful. And in fact, it was so awful that a lot of consumers returned the game, and apparently they had so many returns that they decided to bury it in a landfill in New Mexico, never to be seen again. So I always thought that was just some kind of like urban legend or something, you know, that it never actually happened. But alas, a construction crew was digging around in that landfill and in fact dug up some of the old E.T. cartridges for the Atari. So I guess there was some truth to it after all.
I guess there was, yeah. So this dig has been well documented, and in fact there will be a upcoming full-length feature documentary produced by Xbox Entertainment Studios.
Yeah, so that'll be cool, I guess. It's super strange to see the pictures of, you know, these guys holding up these old cartridges.
it is pretty wild. Now, my understanding is that this game was just sort of haphazardly produced and rushed out to try to capitalize on the brand of E.T. the movie.
Right. Yeah. But the game was just like the worst thing you've ever seen. Like, it didn't even make sense. But yeah, it was in conjunction. Well, so now I'm not sure. Was it in conjunction with the movie, or was it just them capitalizing on it? I'm not sure.
I believe it was a licensed tie-in.
Right. Right. So yeah, was this the maker of this documentary is the one who decided to dig them up? So do you think he was actually looking to find them, and was it actually expecting that he would find them, or that it would be a ruse?
I think he absolutely planned to find them. I mean, it was apparently not a huge secret exactly where they were dug.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Alrighty, well, I think that will do it for this week. Taylor, if somebody were to try to contact you, perhaps through the use of the internet in some way, how would they go about doing this?
Well, I have geocached my contact information along with a copy of Atari's E.T., and I have buried it in a location that you must beat my own custom version of 2048. It's called Taylorphone 2048, and you have to get to 4096 in the game in order to get the geocache location in GPS coordinates. And there you will find my Twitter handle, which is at Taylorphone. Wait, dang it.
Yeah, you just gave yourself away.
Ah.
Just like that.
That's too bad. Well, you'll never find my geocache. Ha 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 ha. But you can tweet me at Taylorphone whenever you want to.
And you can get at me a little more easily. I'm at Chris Hailbarn. So give us a follow. Let us know what you think of the show. So let's get out of here. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, The Movie Podcast, and Home On. You can send us some feedback. We've got an email. It is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter together. We are at @theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Mark.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.